Hello, everybody. Welcome in to the Lakers Collective. We got a lot to talk about today. We're going to be grading some of the Lakers role players. We'll take some of your questions and comments as well about the offseason. I'm Trevor Lane. He's Jason Tipp. Jovan Buha is traveling today. So, Jason, you and I get to hold it down here.
Yeah. Sorry we had to reschedule yesterday. I'm dealing with literally the worst viral illness of my entire life. I left my house today for the first time in 6 days. Ooh. Those of you guys who are longtime Hoops Tonight listeners probably have been able to tell that every single Hoops Tonight recording that I've scrounged out over the last 6 days has literally had me looking like death and struggling to get through. I've never been sick like this in my life. It's crazy. I've had like multiple fevers over 102 degrees. I've had fevers for like 3-4 straight days. It's been just an absolute nightmare, but I think, fingers crossed, that I'm starting to kind of pull myself out of it. So that's at least some good news just in time for game one of the finals. Terrible timing this time of year for something like this. But I am excited to dig into some player grades with you today, Trevor.
Well, I'm glad you're feeling at least a little bit better. And we'll try to keep it as light of a lift today as we can here. But yeah, we're going to get into DeAndre Ayton, Marcus Smart, Rui Hachimura. We're going to talk about on today's show kind of what they've done over the course of the season, how we would ultimately grade them out, and then go from there. But everybody, do me a favor. If you haven't done so yet, please make sure you hit the subscribe button. Double check and see if you're subscribed to the Lakers Collective YouTube channel. If you're not, hit that subscribe button. Turn on those notifications as well so you get notified when we go live. And don't forget to follow us over on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. All right, Jason, let's go here to start. Let's just start with the big man. Let's go with DeAndre Ayton. Give me your thoughts on him, his season, a grade, and perhaps we'll get into a little bit about what his future looks like with the Lakers, if there is a future in LA.
So this was the hardest one for me, Trevor, going kind of back and forth, because like on the one hand, you want to kind of contextualize everything with value, right? And when you talk about a player that makes the amount of money that he makes, it's very easy to just be like, oh, A+, because how many teams can play a center that like less than $10 million and have like games where he outplays Rudy Gobert, games where he outplays Alperen Şengün, games where he like is going toe-to-toe with some of the best centers in the league, or having stretches like he did in March where he looked legitimately like a foundational piece for the Lakers potentially for the next couple of years. So on the one hand, I understand that framing, but that's not actually how this works in a lot of ways, because there's also kind of like a reputation talent piece to this where DeAndre has the downside in this kind of discussion of flashing his ceiling in a way that's like, hey, we know what you can do, which makes the lower end kind of more frustrating. So I ended up landing on a B+ here. And my framework basically was, in the grand scheme of things, there was a certain amount of outperforming his salary, but a certain amount of underperforming his talent, which has become kind of like the hallmark of his career on the talent side in terms of just that frustrating up and down. And, you know, when you look at the fact that in many of the games, J.J. Redick actually ended up opting to play Jaxson Hayes more especially in big spots late in games, I think that reflects here as well. But overall, in the big picture, I think that there's a certain amount of like, when you're dealing with your foundational five, consistency is kind of the most important piece. There's a certain amount of like, when you're trying to have a foundation of a team, you want your top five to be more or less consistent, and then you expect your bench, your reserves, to have a certain amount of volatility, a certain amount of like, hey, this night, I like for the Knicks, like, oh, you know, Jordan Clarkson is having a 15 game stretch where he's a big part of our team, but like, we can also go away from him and, you know, play Jose Alvarado instead if we feel like he's more reliable in this stretch. Or, you know, even just with the Lakers bench, like Vando will have stretches of the season where he's very used, and then other stretches of the season where he's not. Like, you expect that sort of volatility from a bench guy. And so the most important piece of it is the Lakers made a certain investment in DeAndre in this 2-year deal to be like, hey, can you be our starting center? And we left the season going, I'm not sure he is. And that is ultimately why I couldn't give him an A.
You know, I am with you on that. I do think that there's got to be some disappointment with DeAndre Ayton over the course of the season. Now, there were games where he was great. It was a roller coaster of a year. There were ups and downs to this season. But ultimately, was he worth the money that you paid for him? Yes, but he also left you wanting quite a bit more. I mean, I heard before the season started, I heard from within the Lakers the idea that they thought DeAndre Ayton might be the best center that Luka had ever played with, that that is potentially a ceiling for him. He certainly didn't get to that level. That's not what we saw from DA this season. He had his games where he was a monster on the boards. He had his games where his shot was great, where his touch was phenomenal around the rim. To start the season, he was automatic with that 15-foot jumper around the free throw line with a little push shot in the paint. Felt like he never missed those shots. And he even was hustling up and down the floor, but we also saw a very low floor from him. And if you look over the course of the entire season, the Lakers were worse defensively with DeAndre Ayton on the floor. And overall, their net rating was worse when he was out there than when he was not. Now, again, a lot of that can be contextualized by everybody else that's around him and where those lineups optimized. Those are certainly important things, and I don't want to put it all on DA. But they also finished the season ranked 29th out of 30 in opponents' field goal percentage when they get to the rim. That's a really rough spot for the Lakers to be in an area that they have to improve. So I ultimately land at I'm more down on DeAndre Ayton. I guess I'm the one DeAndre hating here, but I'm giving him a C-plus on DA over the course of the season. It's just, it's adequate. He's fine when he's in there. And for the money, I have no problems with what he provides. It's not like you're paying him $20 million and expecting him to just be this key cog here for this team. And that's why I think that if he picks up his player options, we'll talk about in just a minute, it's not a big deal. I think he provides value for the money. But I'm going with that C-plus range because I look at him each and every game and you're just kind of wishing he was a bit better. You're wishing that he could do a little bit more, that he could be that long-term answer at the center position. I think definitively we know he's not. And for as long as he is the starter, you're wishing you had somebody a little bit better. Now, if he becomes a backup, this is a totally different conversation, but I don't know that he's ready to do that. By the way, Jovan did just text me his grades. He has DeAndre Ayton at a B-. So that's where he's got him at. So I finished at a C+. What do you think about the future with DA? He's got an $8.1 million player option. Number one, do you think, Jason, that he picks it up? And if so, or if he doesn't, what does that mean for the Lakers in either direction?
Shout out to Jovan. Hope he's having a safe trip. You guys are the DeAndre Ayton people here, I guess,
yeah.
in today's show. So to me, it's the Ayton piece to me has more to do with if he's there next season. I think there's a certain amount of you can't necessarily depend on him to close games. What I mean by that is, like, there's this big picture goal for the team, right? And that is, in the immediate future, you're hunting for a starting three and a starting five because, God willing, you can convince LeBron to come back and be your starting four as a stopgap, whereas LeBron is, you don't have a short-term solution for the three or the five. And if you get a five and Ayton's your backup, or if he opts out and takes a deal elsewhere, that's great. Now problem is solved. If you don't get a five, and at that point, I think Ayton most likely does opt in because I don't think there's going to be some sort of dramatic amount of money out there for him. I am totally fine with Ayton being the starting center during the regular season if there wasn't some obvious move out there on the market. So, like, say you see, Nick Claxton, they want a first round pick, which I'm not even super like into anymore the way that I used to be. Or you see the amount of money that Mitchell Robinson signs for. You see the amount of money that Robert Williams signs for. And like you go look around and you can kind of go like, okay, I understand why Rob didn't jump on any of these guys. Or maybe the draft picks that were available around 25 weren't necessarily starting caliber center type of prospects. And so Ayton ends up being the fallback option. I think that's actually just fine. I think from there, though, you have to have some sort of plan for what to do if Ayton is unplayable in some sort of series, if you do end up in a playoff series. So whether that's, you know, a small ball look, which I think would require another power forward, so somebody of that LeBron size that can play, because I don't think you can do that with LeBron as your biggest, most athletic player on the floor. I think there needs to be another 6'9", 6'10", kind of big forward that can play in that role in order to make it work. So if Ayton comes back, the main thing I'm looking for there is them just not necessarily needing him in some sort of playoff context under those circumstances. For all the reasons we discussed this year involving you can't afford to punt entire seasons with Luka Doncic anymore. We're already two in. Like, next year is going to be potentially his third playoff run. Obviously, he missed this playoff run with an injury, but his third playoff run with a Laker. Like, that's how long he's already been here. You can't just be like, oh, well, Ayton's what we got. So there's a certain amount of, if he's on the team, it's fine. If he ends up starting a bunch of games, that's fine. But I don't want to feel like if DeAndre Ayton is unplayable in round two, that that's like a death sentence for any of the Lakers' hopes in any sort of playoff matchup.
Yeah, I agree 100%. Yeah, you can't be completely dependent upon Ayton to be that cog there in the middle, because he does have his deficiencies out there on the floor. And in the bigger context of everything the Lakers do this summer, needing it to fit through the lens of what works with Luka, needing it to really work on that level, that's not really DeAndre Ayton, but can you get by with him at the center spot? Sure, you could do it, and he's fine. Again, $8.1 million. I think the Lakers are in good shape regardless of what Ayton does. If Ayton picks up the option, you go, hey, he's fine value at $8.1 million, no problem. If he declines it, okay, we'll take the extra flexibility. I'll tell you what I'm definitely not doing, though, if he declines it, and I don't think he will. I think he picks it up. But if he declines it, what I'm not doing, if I'm the Lakers, if I'm not going back and saying, well, okay, we'll give you a raise off of this then. I'm definitely not doing that. Definitely not doing that. I'm not coming back and saying, okay, we'll do 2 years, 20 or something like that off it. Even a minor bump. If he opts out, fine. Best of luck to you. And we're going to go and we're going to try to find something elsewhere. We're going to go look elsewhere for this. But let me ask you this, because I do think long-term for DeAndre Ayton's career, ultimately, it's going to be as a backup. I think that's his best case scenario, is going to be as a backup. If he wants to get on a team that can really win and really do something, I think he's going to be the reserve rather than the starter. Do you think he is at the point where if the Lakers win and landed, let's say the Lakers land Walker Kessler, right? Just to throw a name out there, or they got Jalen Gardner, whoever comes in at that five spot. Do you think DeAndre Ayton is at a point in his career where he would be accepting of a reserve role?
That is a really interesting question. At a certain point, he wouldn't have a choice.
Right.
I think that there's going to be a kicking and screaming phase, in the same way that there was a kicking and screaming phase going from being a guy who was like getting post touches and stuff to being a traditional screen and roll big, who's a defensive anchor, like, which really come, you know, March this last season, I thought he accepted that role in a lot of ways and was open about that in some of his post-game pressers. I think there would be a similar kicking and screaming phase going from there to doing that in a bench role. I actually have a different question to pitch back at you that I think is interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that DeAndre Ayton improved his reputation / stock as an NBA player between last year in Portland and this year in LA?
I'd say yes. Yes. Not a ton, but the way he was willing to settle into the role that he was in, I thought that does matter. We did see the games, the flashes from him where he hustled, where he's getting up and down the floor, where he's just screening and rolling to the basket, doing those sorts of things. The Lakers need somebody who can do them, I think, at a higher level. Somebody's got, just in general, a baseline of a higher motor. I think that is something that they've got to be very careful of, is around Luka. You want a lot of high motor players, and that's certainly not DeAndre Ayton. But I thought that he did settle into more of that complementary role than certainly what he's been over the course of his career. I don't know if he's ready quite to settle into a I'm the backup type of role, but I did think that as the season went on, where there's some blips on the radar, yes, in terms of wanted his paint touches, and he's not Clint Capella and all those sorts of things, but when push came to shove, he did finish out the season doing a lot more of kind of the dirty work stuff that the Lakers needed from him.
Yeah, you know, I 100% agree. I think that last summer, his reputation was literally in the dumpster. It was as bad as any, you know, talented lottery pick at his age that I can remember. even there was a lot of just like straight up clowning of the Lakers and of Laker fans for kind of being somewhat optimistic. Cause I was aware of all of Ayton's flaws, but I just kept thinking like, this kid's super talented and he's going to be playing with a player in Luka that's going to be able to unlock a certain amount of, you know, just some of his straight up raw talent at the position. And I remember like immediately just seeing a ton of pushback, like this guy's terrible. You guys are going to hate him. And while that stuff still existed to a certain extent this season, Ayton was better than I thought he would be this year, even though I thought he would have some of those moments. So like, to put it very simply, like if there was a certain number of teams that would have signed him at a veteran minimum last summer, I think that number of teams would have increased going into this particular summer. I think he has improved his reputation. I just don't think it's a dramatic amount. I think there's still growth to be had there. And if you're Rob, like that's where, like, let's say you do, to your point, let's say you do get a starter. You get, you know, let's say you get Mitchell Robinson for the purposes of this conversation. You get Mitchell Robinson and you go to Ayton and you're like, here's the deal, dude. Mitch is going to start for us. That was how we pitched him on him coming to us. That was one of our separators in our pitch. But you know, Mitch doesn't play big minutes. We prefer to keep Mitch around 20, 24 minutes, which means you're still going to get 20, 24 minutes. And we're going to go Lively Gafford, you know, style, just line shifts at the center position, keeping you guys fresh, just out there playing really hard for 4 minute bursts. Like, I think that Ayton has shown enough growth in his personality over the last year that there's a case to be made that Rob convincing Ayton to come back and embrace that role and Ayton's willingness to do it could be really good for Ayton's future and in whatever potential next opportunity he has after this. So like, I think like it's really the question to me isn't whether or not he improved year over year, because he did. It's whether or not he's willing to keep walking that path, because there's a version of this story that ends kind of like Dwight Howard in 2020, where like you have a role player season where you come off the bench and dominate, and it like Dwight's entire career is viewed differently now because of what he accomplished with the Lakers in 2020. And I think like, do I think Ayton will have that moment specifically with the Lakers? Maybe not. It'll probably be on a really good team in a couple years somewhere else in the league. But I think that pathway starts with him continuing to follow this path that he's already set out on when he made this decision to come to LA. And I think, like, ironically, something like him embracing a bench role might even help him in that regard by understanding, like, nothing is given. Everything has to be earned in this rotation.
I agree 100%. And that's what I keep thinking of Dwight and his DA there. Dwight was almost out of the league. It took him getting to that point. I don't think DA is...
His contract is non-guaranteed.
Right, exactly.
Non-guaranteed minimum.
It took Dwight getting to that point. I mean, what a difference between Dwight Howard, his first stint with the Lakers, and second stint where he just, I'm just going to set screens. I'm going to roll hard to the basket. I'm going to rebound. I'm going to block shots. And I don't care about my minutes. I don't care about anything. I'm just here for the team, right? That is such a change. I don't know that DeAndre Ayton is quite there yet, but I do think ultimately he's going to get there, and he's going to be, I think, one of the better backup bigs in the NBA. Let me ask you this before we move on. What are your thoughts on if you get, let's say, in that scenario that you laid out, Mitch Robinson, DA, you're still going to get a lot of minutes. You're coming off the bench. What would you do with Jaxson Hayes in that scenario? Would you keep him or would you part ways?
Mitchell Robinson's had his injury quirks. Ayton, if he gets the slightest bump or bruise, leaves the game. I wouldn't hate the idea of keeping Jaxson on the roster at a relatively low number. Do you think Jaxson is still a vet minimum player in this league?
No, I think he's about that. I think you use his $4.5 million cap hold. I kind of envision him getting like Jake LaRavia's deal, $6 million.
Okay.
That's what I've got him at.
Okay. In the universe, let's kind of come up with a number for Mitch. What do you think Mitch's number would look like? You think like 20, 25?
I'm thinking, yeah, that 18 to 20-ish range. We'll see. I'm curious, though. Did you see the report about, obviously, his fifth metacarpal break? I went, oop, boxer's fracture. Yep. What's the real story there? Hopefully everything's good with him. Sounds like he is going to play game one. But I do think, especially if he has a big finals, yeah, we're probably talking that like 18 to 20-ish range. Maybe I think it'll be above MLE money. Let's put it that way. I think somebody's going to have to come in with more than the mid-level in order to get him.
Okay, so let's say for the sake of argument that it's 20, just to have a nice round number.
Sure.
So in that universe, Ayton comes back on his 8.1. And like you said, we're getting around Jake LaRavia money for Jackson Hayes, so around $6 million. So you would have essentially $34 million tied up, but in three centers that all could spot start.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's not a terrible allocation of resources for a Luka Doncic team. Not to mention they're all pretty tradable salaries relative to the deals that they're on.
In a league where the cap is $165 million, I don't think that's out of the question to have your center spot locked down with that much money.
Ayton, let's say that it's like, you know, 3 years, $18 million. Or not Ayton, sorry, Jackson. Jackson on 3 years, 18, any team who's looking for a backup center that saw value in him, that's an asset.
Yeah.
You know, agreed. Ayton as an $8 million expiring, that's not a difficult deal to trade. Mitchell Robinson, obviously, let's call it 4 years, 80. It's a little more complicated depending on how well he plays. But I mean, I think Mitch is a good basketball player. I think the thing with Mitch that is like kind of intriguing, at least. And I was more talking with Mitch with regard to your question, specifically talking about whether or not Ayton would embrace a bench role. Because Mitch kind of strikes me as the kind of guy where you wouldn't play Mitch 35 minutes. Agreed. But I think Mitch is an extremely underrated defensive player. I think that Mitch is one of the best, like, at the level kind of pick and roll defenders in the league. He's very good at contesting jump shooters. He does a lot of things really, really well. So like that's an intriguing kind of idea in terms of going for like a legitimate center upgrade that has a certain amount of like real physical imposition on the game while still giving you this three center rotation where like different matchups kind of call for different types of guys. That's intriguing to me.
Yeah, I think it would be an interesting way to go if you can't get the guy that's locked in, that, you know, Walker Kessler, Jalen Durant, somebody like that. You can't get that guy. It's getting a few different options and stylistically having them have some differences between them so that you can have J.J. Redick has the ability to mix and match skill sets and really go with whatever it is that's going to work in that situation. I also think if you're going to go in on Mitch Robinson, who knows, maybe the Knicks win the whole thing here and they run it back and so he doesn't leave. But if you do go in on a player like Mitch Robinson, same conversation with Rob Williams, you want to have depth at the center position because of that injury history. So you got to be able to make sure that you back yourself up in that situation by having, I think, that third big on the roster. And Jackson Hayes, he's got the mind meld with Luka. He's playing for Slovenia now. I just don't see Hayes leaving. And if Ayton picks up the option, I'd at least like to bring in one more guy that could ideally start and then go with that. I hesitate to call it a three-headed monster because I don't know if it's really monstrous, but that three big rotation there at the center spot, having those options for JJ, I think that could be a good path going forward if you're not able to land the guy that you want to be your 30-minute a night big man moving forward.
Rob Williams is an interesting example of a third center for that type of rotation too. And I mean, theoretically he's at a like probably half that, like in the 10 to 12 million a year, I'm guessing. Maybe he could punches higher, but he's had, you know, so many health issues over the years. But like Rob Williams is another kind of guy where you like see three distinctly different types of centers, where Jackson is this floor running vertical spacer, Robert Williams is this like defensive anchor vertical spacer, and then Ayton's like the more skilled kind of physical player. I think the three center rotation build, especially when guys are on relatively discounted salaries, makes sense in the context of like, I don't want to pay $30 million to a center unless that dude is awesome. Like unless that dude is literally awesome. And it's just hard to find, like, so let's say, for instance, you got, you know, Robert Williams around the MLE, like you'd be paying those three centers just a little bit more than you'd pay Nick Claxton if you traded for him, you know?
I think I actually kind of like that over Nick Claxton.
Exactly.
Yeah, I'd rather do that. All right, we need to move on to Marcus Smart. We'll talk a bit about him, but first, a quick shout out to our sponsor, and that is Prize Picks. You guys can check them out. And one of the cool things the Prize Picks has for tonight for game one of the NBA Finals is a Jalen Brunson 0.5 points, a freebie. I think we know which way that's going to go. Use the code HMA, play $5, get $50 instantly. Jalen Brunson, I still like, Jason. I've been finding the Steph Castle 11.5 points. It's still been up there for me. I've been comboing that with everything. Jalen Brunson at 0.5, obviously, is an even better play. This one's a no-brainer. There's some really good ones out there right now. But Jalen Brunson, 0.5, to me, this is it's a free square. It's easy. And you got to love it when they throw in promos like this to kick off the NBA Finals. All right, everybody, go check them out. Check out Prize Picks. Use the link in the description down below. That code is HMA. Play $5, get $50 instantly. All right, let's talk a bit about Marcus Smart. So I viewed Marcus Smart as the gasoline on the fire for the Lakers, that LeBron, Luka, and Austin together as a trio as the season went on, despite all the noise that got made midseason. By the time we got to the end of the season, they were a huge net positive with the three of them on the floor. However, when you included Marcus Smart with those three players, the numbers go through the roof. They were just shy of being plus 16 per 100 possessions, which is absolutely absurd with the four of them on the floor together. I think Marcus Smart was such a stylistic fit for the Lakers and a defensive need. But Jason, where do you go with his season in totality? Did have some injury issues, certainly had his games where the wayward shooting was a concern. What did you think about what he provided the team this year? What grade do you put him at? And then what does that mean for the future?
This was by far the easiest one for me.
Yeah.
It's an A+. I mean, we talked about the relative to the salary piece, like the relative to his salary, just you got a starting caliber 3-and-D player who like legitimately shot the basketball really well over the final, you know, few months of the season. I'm trying to pull the numbers right now. I think he was at, you know, he was about 36% on 4.4 attempts per game over his final 32 games. He had a stretch there in March where he was shooting over 40% for a good chunk of that. He, even if we talked about the relative to like reputation and talent, like, you know, Marcus is not a guy that goes out there and flashes like otherworldly talent where you feel like he's not tapping into it the way that we talked about with DeAndre Ayton. There, you got a player who constantly went out and played as hard as he possibly could and maximized his individual talent on a nightly basis. The availability piece, which was a huge question mark coming into the season, he ends up playing 62 games, which is more than his previous two seasons combined. It's the fifth most games he's played in an entire season in his career. So you get like a great availability season. He outpunches his weight class all season long and legitimately fills a position of desperate need there at the starting small forward group. You mentioned the on-off numbers. He's far and away the best on-off player in the entire league. He slots up into a primary ball handling role in the Rockets series. And yeah, don't get me wrong, it got frustrating against the Thunder because the Thunder are just the Thunder. And guess what? Marcus isn't good enough to be that high usage in that role. But like, the truth of the matter is like, I don't see the case for Marcus anything other than an A+. Like, the dude just absolutely exceeded expectations in every single category. I became a massive believer and fan of him this year. I like, obviously, what number he gets this offseason complicates matters to a certain extent. But, like, I want that dude on my basketball team. And, like, I just, one of my favorite players that I've rooted for in my time being an NBA fan.
Agreed. I really remember when the draft came along that year. What was that? Was that 2014? Anyway, when the Celtics were picking at 6 and the Lakers were at 7, and the Lakers wound up getting Julius Randle at 7, who turned into a good NBA player. But I remember in that draft hoping Marcus Smart would fall to the Lakers. And I thought this season we got to see everything that back then I was hoping that would be in a Lakers jersey if had they gotten Marcus Smart. He was absolutely fantastic. The defensive effort, the hustle, every single play, that was there. I think he's a defensive floor raiser, but he's also a contagious defender. And by that, I mean that everybody around him picks up their defense because of the hustle on his side of things. J.J. Redick oftentimes was given defensive directions through Marcus Smart, trusting him to be a coach on the floor, communicating things to the rest of the team. There were moments where he made boneheaded mistakes, where he took shots that he should not take, where he had that one inbound early on in the season where he stepped over the line and turned it over at a critical moment for the Lakers. Every once in a while, he does stuff where you're like, man, a veteran player shouldn't be making those mistakes, but it's well worth that. The juice is worth the squeeze. What he gives you everywhere else on the floor and what he gives you as a defensive floor raiser is so, so important to this team. I think they need more players like Marcus Smart, not less. They need more guys with his kind of attitude, with his demeanor, his skill set. So important for the Lakers. So I also go A-plus relative to the salary. When you look at what you actually were paying him, I thought he was absolutely fantastic. I loved what we got out of Marcus Smart all season long. He was the gasoline on the fire to the Lakers. Now, interestingly, again, we had Jovan's text here. He's got Marcus as a B-plus. But
Jovan.
Which, to me, Jovan was the guy all year pushing for Marcus to be in the starting lineup, and now he's dinging him with a B-plus. He'll have some explaining to do when he gets back on Jovan. That one. But I don't see how he cannot be at the very least an A if you want to ding him on some of the shooting issues or things like that. But Jason, I thought Marcus Smart was fantastic. And I think a big part of this summer is, can you hang on to Marcus Smart and really add more pieces like him to this roster?
A couple of quick, before we talk more offseason with Marcus, a couple of quick stats. He led the team in clutch points in the playoffs. He had 17.
Really?
Had two clutch threes, which was more than anyone else on the team. The other one I was going to pull up was his fourth quarter threes in the regular season, because I could have sworn he made a million of those, like, just big fourth quarter threes for the Lakers. But more than anything, when it came to like the Lakers are just better when he plays, there were so many like big momentum shots and momentum plays that Laker role players were just kind of unable to make at various points during the season. And it just felt like Marcus was one of those guys that just consistently came through. As a matter of fact, fourth quarter threes, Luka, Austin, and Rui led the team predictably. Luka, 254. That's the whole season. Let me change it to fourth quarter real quick. But
I was going to say, that's a lot of threes.
Yeah, that's a lot of threes. That would be a little that'd be a little ridiculous. Luka's really good, but maybe not that good. But Marcus Smart hit 28 fourth quarter threes this year at 37%. That was the third most on the team. So Austin led the team with 43. Luka was second with 34. Marcus was literally, beyond the two primary ball handlers of the team, the most reliable fourth quarter 3-point shooter. 28 for 76 at 37%. He also was a weirdly dependable free throw shooter for the Lakers in like big spots late in games when they needed to handle pressure and get the ball up the floor. He just did so many little things. Now, where it gets complicated is for the offseason. This is where I do want to go back to the very first point that I was making when I was giving him his grade, which is that there was never a point where you felt like Marcus was underachieving relative to his talent. But the talent is what it is, which is he's pretty quick on his feet, but he's not like this lightning quick Davion Mitchell-esque beat you to spots every single time type of defender. He's got decent size for the position, but he's not, you know, like Alex Caruso or J-Dub, you know, in terms of like big physical guards on the perimeter. He was a somewhat unreliable 3-point shooter. He could handle some ball handling responsibilities up to a point. You know, the decision making was really good, but also came with mistakes. All of this was fine for what he was as a placeholder in the starting lineup while the Lakers searched for the small forward of the future. But I do feel concerned about paying Marcus some massive salary when I don't see him as like the kind of guy that can necessarily be one of your core five guys at the end of games. Like, I think you could get away with that if he's far and away your fifth best player in that lineup. But I think that requires, so like, say for instance, they did get just a really good center, like a Rudy Gobert or something like that. Then yeah. Do I think Marcus could be the fifth alongside Rudy, LeBron, Austin, and Luka? Yeah, that'd be one thing. But like, I'm hesitant to tilt that value proposition too far out of whack by giving him starter money, if that makes sense. But I also would, really quick, I wouldn't blame Marcus if he went out to go get that somewhere else, as he should. He's in a phase of his career where, and Marcus should absolutely be thinking, I'm in my early 30s, I want one more big NBA deal.
And so that's the key
problem with that.
That's the key here for the Lakers for moving forward, because as much as we can be singing Marcus Smart's praises, we also have to recognize that he has not played in a lot of games recently. So if you're going to sign him to a new deal, and we talk about the last few years, you've got to take that into consideration. You've got to have some team protection built into whatever that deal is. And then you got to come up with a dollar amount, because part of the reason why Marcus Smart was so effective this year is because he was on such a small contract, at least from the Lakers side of things, right? He's getting more money from Washington where he was bought out. But from the Lakers side of things, he's getting a small contract, and that helped have enough pieces around him on the roster this season. If suddenly you're paying him, I don't know, $20 million a year, well, then some of his flaws become a little bit more difficult to tolerate. So I'm not suggesting they give him $20 million. I tend to look at, should the Lakers be a cap space team, the room exception being the target with him, that $9 million. And if I'm going to do that, I don't want to do a three-year deal with Marcus Smart with his injury history. Ideally, I'd like to do a two-year deal and have some team protection on the second half of that with some non-guaranteed money, maybe a team option, something like that. But Jason, what's the breaking point number for Marcus Smart in order to keep him versus let him go? Is there a certain number where you'd say, you know what, hey, you got this much money, Chicago called up and offered $20 million, we wish you the best, but we're not going to go there. What is that number for you for Marcus Smart?
Man, so much of this is in the context of like who else the Lakers get, you know?
Yeah.
Because you need a certain amount of talent on the floor, and like if you don't have a better option, and you can't just afford to let him walk for nothing if you don't have anybody else who can play the position. Like for instance, like say Rui gets a big deal somewhere and leaves, and LeBron decides to go to Golden State, and then it's like, are you going to let Marcus walk too? And now your team just sucks. You know what I mean? Right. So there's a certain amount of like the context matters, but I start to get a little queasy at like 15 for a guy like Marcus.
I'm right there with you. And let me ask you this. That room exception number that I'm talking about, let's say you have to use a little bit more, maybe you get up to, you know, the 12, 13, whatever range you're in. If it costs you Luke Kennard to do it, if it means you no longer have the ability, the flexibility to bring back Luke Kennard, are you willing for that to make that trade-off and keep Marcus Smart over Kennard?
I prefer Marcus over Luke. I really like Luke. I think Luke is an excellent like floor raising regular season player. Mm-hmm. Who I just think like I think a Lakers team that has Luke Kennard just has a better chance to compete night in and night out in the regular season and get that kind of churn out 50 win seasons kind of vibe that the Lakers have had now for a couple years in a row. I just think in any playoff series, Marcus is dramatically more playable, and that ultimately is what matters the most, because there's a certain amount of like you can replicate and manufacture success in the regular season through culture, through system, through depth, through certain types of things. But in the postseason, you are the players that you can play that are actually capable of playing in that specific matchup. And if I had to choose between, because I kind of feel the same way about Luke Kennard, where like I start to get queasy once we get into the double digit millions.
Yeah.
And like if I had to choose between one of those two, I would take Marcus.
Agreed. Yeah, I think his defense is too important to this team. All right, so we're pretty high on Marcus Smart in general. Hopefully he does stick around. The dream scenario is he picks up that player option. I don't see him doing it. I think it's $5.3, almost $5.4 million player option. He picks that up, and I mean, the Lakers should be taking a victory lap, because that would be phenomenal to have him on the books at that salary for another year. I think it's very unlikely. If I were Marcus Smart's agent, I would be advising him to strike while the iron is hot. You just had a pretty healthy season. You played well, opt out of that deal, and then sign a longer-term contract to at least get more long-term certainty to protect yourself. But if he were to pick that up, I'd be thrilled. That would be huge, I think, for the Lakers. All right, let's talk a little bit about Rui Hachimura and the season that he had. Three straight years now of better than 50% from the field, better than 40% from three. Only Rui and Kevin Durant did that over the last 3 years. Pretty impressive, right? Leaves you wanting a little bit when it comes to defense, when it comes to rebounding. We can talk about his fit in the team structure. But Jason, where do you go on Rui Hachimura and the season that he had?
This is the hard one for me from the standpoint of like the context, because I look at Rui as a guy that on his last deal was making starter money, and that on his next deal, in all likelihood, will be making starter money, because I think that's what the market value will show, especially after how well he shot the basketball in the postseason this year. The thing that gets tougher, there's two things with me with Rui that make this conversation complicated. One, the lack of aggression unless the circumstances are perfect, meaning like he's not a player that is going to shoot when he's under a certain amount of duress. Now, he's countered that by adding that rip-through pull-up, which has become a super reliable play for him, and he does deserve a good amount of credit for that. But it's not like he's a player in that Michael Porter Jr. class that's putting in an enormous amount of volume in spot-up situations relative to the rest of the league, especially when you factor in the context of who he's playing with. Like, he's playing legitimately with – like, he was 42nd in the NBA in spot-up opportunities this year. 42nd, playing alongside Austin Reeves and Luka Doncic at 6'9". So, like, as a player that should just be able to shoot over the top quite a bit, like, there's a certain amount of, like, I just wish there was more aggression out of him in that spot to justify, like, I'd rather see his percentages drop to him being like a 47% field goals, 36% from three, but the volume is considerably higher on that on those looks, because I just think that that carries more value. The second piece of it is, and I want to be very clear before I say this, like, Rui being just a fucking knockdown three-point shooter was a huge asset in the postseason this year, and I expect someone to throw some money at him, and he'll deserve it because of that simple fact that he's one of the most reliable spot-up shooters in the league. But once a player starts making over $20 million to me, I want him to be able to impact the game in a bunch of different ways. I like look at Jaden McDaniels as an example. Now, mind you, he's making 30, so it's another salary class above where Rui Hachimura is. But like, he is a dynamic offensive player in a variety of different ways, whether it's like he shot over 40% from three this year. He is excellent at racking closeouts, has a certain amount of ball handling ability to attack size mismatches and to play in transition and to work on the offensive glass. But he's also like an apex perimeter defender in the NBA and just a dominant athlete all over the floor. There's a certain amount of like, I want a Swiss Army knife if you're as a role player, if you're making north of $20 million. And so it's less to me about does Rui deserve 20, 25? Because let's say 25, because I think that's probably sure. The number that Rui gets. It's not to me whether or not Rui deserves 25. It's whether or not the Lakers are the right team for him to be making 25. Because of the fact that they have a team that is anchored by Austin Reeves and Luka Doncic, two athletically inferior players. That's where that conversation gets complicated for me. So looking in the past, based on his like $18 million salary, started a lot of games over the course of this contract, started a lot of games this year, I land at about a B. But I think it gets complicated as to whether or not the Lakers actually make sense for him as a long-term kind of like home under the circumstances that I just broke down.
With Rui, I love that he's a playoff riser. It's a crazy stat, but the NBA's all-time playoff three-point percentage leader for Rui Hachimura, I love that. The shooting ability is phenomenal. He does a great job making teams pay for paying too much attention to Luka or LeBron or Austin. Those guys get into the paint, and Rui Hachimura will absolutely kill you from behind the arc, and he's got the ability to attack the closeout with that pull-up. I do agree with the aggressive piece that you were talking about, but if we're going to knock DeAndre Ayton for the low motor and we're going to praise Marcus Smart's motor, we also have to mention Rui Hachimura. The motor concerns, I think, are real there. He's not a fit in that regard with Luka, with Austin, as being a player that you've got to have flying all over the court. That's not Rui Hachimura. And you start stacking that up, right? You've got Luka, you've got Austin, you got LeBron, who on a random Wednesday in January is not going to be a high motor player. You go to a player like Rui, you add DeAndre Ayton, and suddenly you've got a lot of low motor players all playing together on the floor, and that can create some problems. That's part of why Marcus Smart popped the way that he did, was because he's got that super high motor. He's flying all over the place, and he was more playable than a guy like, say, a Jared Vanderbilt. So there's good and bad with Rui Hachimura. What he is good at, it's not even that he's good. He is elite at what it is that he does well. But it's the other stuff that gives you reason to pause. Now, when you say he's going to get like that $25 million, by the way, I come in at a B+ for Rui Hachimura. I thought overall, especially when we get into the playoffs, very strong finish to the season. Loved that. The problem that you run into with Rui is if you pay him above, say, MLE money, well, then you're kind of saying this needs to be a starter for our club. And if LeBron comes back, we'll see if he does. I don't know that Rui's going to slot into a starting role for the Lakers. I think he's a really nice player off the bench, but how much do you want to pay guys coming off the bench? I think that's going to be a key conversation for the Lakers to sort through here. You don't want to lose him for nothing. You don't want to just let him go. He's a very, very good player, but that number's got to be just right for him. Made $18 million last season. I'm hoping that you can get him somewhere around that same number, but if it does start getting up there, Jason, here's the nice thing is that I think there will be a number of teams that will be more than happy to give Rui Hachimura their full mid-level exception if he's willing to take that. San Antonio, Detroit, right? Some scary teams that will be more than happy to give Rui Hachimura the full MLE, right? He would be incredible there. If you're the Lakers, my hope is that they use the strategy the Wolves use with Naz Reid and you offer him a little bit more before free agency even begins to not even listen to anybody else. The Lakers can extend him all the way up till June 30th, offer him 17 and see if he'll take it. And if he won't and say, look, we're going to give you $2 million more than the mid-level. And in exchange for that $2 million, we want you to not even listen to any other team. You're not going to hit free agency at all. Sign an extension right now. That's what you're looking to do there. If you won't take that, though, and you're saying maybe a team could offer him $25 million, the only teams with cap space to do that may be Detroit if they really make some decisions here with their roster. But you're looking at Chicago and Brooklyn. Otherwise, if a team wants to give Rui $25 million, the nice part for the Lakers side of this is we'd have to be talking a sign and trade. So in that scenario where Rui does get, let's say Rui gets a $25 million offer from Detroit. Hey, we want to give you $25 million. Great. You need the Lakers' help in order to do it. Again, unless Detroit makes some tough decisions, maybe with Duncan Robinson or something like that. But we're probably talking sign and trade here. So there's a world where Rui gets his big payday and the Lakers still are able to get something from him via sign and trade. So that I think if he does get the big offer would be the ideal scenario. Otherwise, I'm hoping they can hang on to Rui, but that also means that you've got to be super intentional with every other decision making on the roster, because once again, we saw it play out over the season, you're starting to dangerously stack up a lot of lower motor players.
Naz Reid is such an interesting comp because his current deal, 21.5 this season, 23.2 next year, 25 the following year, 26.7 the following year, 28 in the 29-30 season. That would be, you know, that's that rough $25 million per year AAV type of contract that, you know, Rui could potentially fetch this summer. I just think Naz is a way better basketball player.
Oh, yeah, I agree. I think Naz is better than Rui. I would agree with that. I think he's a phenomenal value on the team. I think Naz Reid is
so great value. That's the thing. Like, it's so funny how it goes when you're having these conversations. Because, like,
right.
I'm not sure I do love Naz on my team at like $35 million, you know? Because, like, right? It just everything gets complicated based on it's just hard. It's like when you're playing those pick your all time lineup or God forbid, some of those, like, different kinds of NFL fantasy drafts where you do it with like dollars instead of like a draft order. It's like, it's just really difficult to decide how you're going to parse out your resources. And like, I think that's where, you know, if you can find a player that is, instead of being a, you know, 47% unguarded catch and shoot 3-point shooter, but instead he's like 42-43%. And is actually kind of a better rebounder and a little bit more useful defensively, but he makes half as much money. Those are the kinds of guys that I think Rob needs to be looking for. I just don't think under the circumstances with Luka and Austin, just right off the bat, you got to count on those two making over $100 million. If that's your baseline for the next era of Lakers basketball, you can't have dudes making over $10 million that are one-dimensional basketball players. You just can't. You need to have everyone who's taking up a substantial salary slot outside of those two needs to be able to check a lot of boxes for you around your two stars, because your two stars are not guys that are checking boxes in those physical imposition parts of the game.
And so I only threw Naz out there as a strategy for how the Wolves signed
him. Oh, no.
But yes. So when we're talking about the, you know, checking boxes, then let's say Rui go again, because Rui could he could sign a, like right this minute he could sign an extension with the Lakers and it could be done. Rui goes to the Lakers and says, yo, I'll start $17 million, start me there, give me a 3-year deal, whatever it comes out to be, like $55 million, whatever, 3-year deal. What should the Lakers do? Because I agree with you that ultimately you've got to have guys to check multiple boxes. If you could get a, what I think would be relative pretty good value, you know, it's pretty similar to the deal that he was on before, but you're right, he doesn't check all the boxes the Lakers need checked. So what should they do in that scenario?
Oh man.
It's easier if Rui says, I want 25, to say, well, congrats on getting 25. We can't quite go there. But if he comes in at a reasonable number, how do you handle that?
So I'm going to say what I said when we were talking earlier about Marcus, where so much of it just depends on the context. Like, I think, for instance, if LeBron walks, you have to pay Rui, because Rui is the closest thing to a starting caliber sure. player among that group that you're talking. Let's say you do a sign and trade with San Antonio because San Antonio wants a shooting forward. Would you be interested in Keldon Johnson back?
Yeah. I mean, the reigning sixth man of the year.
Keldon is a guy that can be frustrating sometimes, and he's certainly shown those moments in the postseason. But he's been like not a good 3-point shooter by any stretch of the imagination, but he's hit some timely ones. God, did he hit 2 big threes in game 7 mm-hmm. of that series. So here's a good example. He's hitting 36% on his threes in the postseason, but he's also like a dynamic athlete who can handle the ball a little bit, pressure the rim a little bit in a way that can be maddening sometimes as he turns the ball over, kind of over penetrates, but he's also like a very good rebounder. And so like, to just more as like a thought exercise here,
right?
Would you rather more so pay Keldon actual... Johnson 17.5, or would you rather pay, you know, Rui Hachimura in that 20-25 range? Like that's where Keldon I think Johnson. It would be fascinating. Is like if you could sign and trade Rui and give him what he wants, which is his like next big deal in the NBA, but pull back a player that's maybe not as apex at his shooting talent, but that brings more of a variety of traits to the table. That San Antonio kind of like Keldon Johnson framework is fascinating to me.
I think he's more the mentality that you need to from the way he approaches the game. The force that he plays the game with is more what you'd be looking for alongside Luka. So if that were, and again, that's just a, as you're saying, it's not a real, like San Antonio would definitely do this type thing. But in terms of a thought exercise, who would you rather have? I think I'd rather go with Keldon Johnson for his fit with this Lakers team. Even though he isn't as good of a shooter, he provides, I think, the other stuff, in addition to a little bit more grit to him, the toughness and all of that, that he provides. So if you could do something along those lines, yeah. And if Rui gets his big payday, hey, congratulations. And by the way, he would be awesome. And I fully expect he would shoot 85% from three whenever the Spurs played the Lakers. And then that's the way that would go, because we know that's how that would happen. But I do think that's a fair point to make. I wonder if that opportunity is out there. Actually, you know what we should do? Let's go right back to the old familiar. If you could turn Rui Hachimura this summer into Andrew Wiggins, would you do it?
Yes, absolutely. Okay. Like, I think what would be really fascinating about that specific dynamic is like it creates this kind of two timelines, at the risk of sounding like an idiot, the two timelines type of dynamic, where, because there really are two timelines with this Lakers group, where it's like the what if we get LeBron to come back and we have like a short term window of like 1 to 2 seasons where we're competing for a championship, but we're also trying to build sustainably around Luka for the future. Doing something like pulling Andrew Wiggins without having to give up any sort of legitimate draft compensation, that in the context of giving the front office then at that point 2 full seasons or 4 full cycles to like figure out the margins, like hit on a you know, maybe the 2026 25th pick, or to find a second round pick that can be a rotation player. Your pro scouting department finds a vet minimum guy who can be a key rotation player. You know, giving yourself an opportunity for several cycles for new investments in the front office to kind of reap rewards in the form of rotation talent. But you could have in the short term, like a perfect 3-and-D starting three in Andrew Wiggins and a perfect starting four in LeBron James, and give Luka a great chance to compete in the short term while you try to round out the margins. Like, I continue to think Wiggins would be a perfect fit with this Lakers team. It's just, he just never made sense to really send out much in the form of assets for, simply because of the fact that he, is in his 30s.
Okay. So Wiggins at 30 million or Rui at 20?
Is it that, I think is Wiggins it enough? Does enough to justify his salary.
Okay.
I think Wiggins is close to that Jaden McDaniels-esque, like, just Swiss Army knife, do everything athlete.
Yeah, I can see that. That's where, if Miami actually gets Giannis, maybe the Lakers can sneak in, absorbing some salary, and off you go, using some of their cap space. Kind of interesting thing there.
The question is, would Miami be interested in Rui if they've already got Giannis and Bam?
Correct. Yeah, then it becomes a little bit, I think he could still be a decent fit there, but...
Yeah, switch everything, you know, just with and the shooting. Yeah. You need shooting around those two.
For sure. All right, let's get to a few of our super chats here before we close out the show. Kevin said, we had this conversation last show, as I recall. Would you, Miles Turner, be a good target for the Lakers? Ultimately, we landed on no. He's a good player. He's better than DeAndre Ayton, but the fit is just not exactly what you want. He was more of a conversation when the Lakers had Anthony Davis. If you wanted to go with the too big look, playing alongside AD, just using his floor spacing, more so than this is the type of guy that we want to put around Luka long term as the guy at the center position.
I remember I was higher on Miles than you and Jovan were, but it's pretty simple to me. It's once again about the context. Like, what am I sending out for him, and what is his salary slot costing me on the back
end?
Like, if I have a better feel for that, like if I don't feel like I'm losing out on one of my key targets for the offseason because of it, and if I'm not giving out any draft compensation, I'm all in. I just think Miles is better than DeAndre. But, like,
I mean, hell, if he's seen as a bad contract and Milwaukee is even, you know, parting with a second round pick or something to compensate you a little bit for taking on his money, then it becomes, I think, more interesting. But like you said, a lot of it comes down to opportunity cost in these situations. Let's go here. Austin Reeves signed a trade to the Pacers for Andrew Nembhard and Ben Shepherd.
That's so much more interesting than it should be.
Yeah, right. I keep going back. I'm like, with the Pacers? Wait, but with the Lakers? I like Nembhard a lot. I don't know.
God, that's interesting. My instinct is like no, just because I'm such a big Austin guy. But like, Nembhard makes 18 this year, 19.5 next year, and then 21.
I like
Ben
that.
Ben Shepherd makes 2.7 this year, and he's got a team option for 5 coming this upcoming season. I like Ben Shepherd.
Would the Pacers do it? The chat says that the Pacers would not do that.
Yeah, the only reason why the Pacers can't do that is because Austin in that sign-and-trade is going to want his money, and you've got $100 million tied up in Tyrese Halliburton and Pascal Siakam. Yeah, I don't think the Pacers do that, but like the idea of, because what we've always talked about with the Austin piece of it is like getting back some sort of ball handling talent, and like, I think Nembhard is kind of a fascinating option there, but again, it's all about context, like, because I'm taking back less salary in this case. Is this a version of the offseason where I'm getting a bunch of other shit too as a result? Like, but yeah, my gut says no, I'm sticking with no. I'm just an Austin fan, and as intriguing as that is, I just think Austin makes the Lakers better.
I think historically, based on what the Lakers have done with Austin, the answer would be no from their side. Not necessarily from us, like, because I think there's real value to Nembhard, but from the Lakers side, they've long had this stance of, if we're going to move Austin, it needs to be for a player that we view as significantly better, right? We're getting the guy the star we want slotted next to Luka long term. I don't know that Nembhard necessarily clears that bar for them.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It's easy. Lakers just need to get better players. Yeah. Hashtag analysis. I love it. D Cash said, thanks for making my lunch break more enjoyable. Keep it up, fellas. Well, thank you for being here.
Thanks, D Cash. Appreciate
you. If Gafford versus three-point spacer was a three-point spacer, the Mavs would have beat the Celtics.
See if Rob Williams keeps shooting threes, because that would be kind of like your intriguing, like maybe can stretch five a tiny bit. But they let him shoot the entire Spurs series, and he went, 3 for 9 in the Spurs series.
But he was a good corner three shooter over the course of the season.
Yeah, I think Robert Williams is an intriguing like discount option. It's always just been the health with him. But I mean, he played in 59 games this year. It's a big step forward. That's actually the most he's played since the 2022 Celtics run.
Oh, geez. You know, he actually shot even better than I thought.
Looks crazy.
Oh, he was only okay. I was going to say he shot 42% on corner threes, but he was 8 of 19 on the season. We'll see if that's real or not. But if Gafford was a three-point spacer, Mavs would have beat the Celtics. Yeah, I mean, maybe, but let's go here. Your centers can't just be rim runners, need versatility. Well, that's where that three-headed center model that we were talking about has some extra value, in that you can mix and match a bit more. You could say, hey, we need more physicality in the paint. Let's go with this guy. Or we need more rim protection. Let's go with this guy. JJ Redick could kind of call upon the center that best fits the situation, more so than you're locked into playing this particular player 35 minutes every night.
I'm going to rephrase this question and just be like, your centers can't just be rim runners. They need to also be able to defend the rim. Like that.
Yes.
That is the key, like, frustration with the Lakers center rotation, is it's like Ayton and Jackson all had big offensive games, and they certainly have moments on defense, but neither of them was just like a steady defensive force, which is really the thing that's frustrating when you look at all the teams that made deep postseason runs this year. They all had guys, like whether it was Jared Allen and Evan Mobley or Mitchell Robinson, and frankly I think Kat deserves some credit for how well he defended this year. The Chet Holmgren, Isaiah Hartenstein duo, like, you know, look at not just Wemby, but that incredible play Cornette made down the stretch of game 7. Like, there's a certain, like, look at how much Gobert dominated in the first round against Jokic. Like, I just don't think the Lakers have enough defensive firepower at the center position.
What do you think about this concept? If you have three centers, you have zero. This is something we hear in football a lot. You know, if a team says we've got three quarterbacks we're auditioning, or three running backs, that really means that you don't have anybody that's good enough to be your starter. Do you think that applies here?
I just think I'd invert it. I'd be like, okay, we have zero centers, so let's have three. That's the way I look at it. Meaning, like, we don't have a guy that we know we can count on, so let's have three kind of different guys, so that we can target the situation. Oh, like tonight's one of those nights where Ayton's got it. He's clearly the guy. He's the most talented. Or like, you know, Luka's in his freaking bag tonight and he's cooking these dudes. We want our best vertical spacer out there. Let's play Jackson. Or like, Jackson's struggling, Ayton's struggling. We need defense. So Robert Williams is our guy tonight, you know. And like one of those nights, you know, Robert plays 26 minutes and the other two guys split the remaining 22 minutes. Or one of those nights, it's pretty even across the board. One of the nights, a dude's injured. One of the nights, a dude's mentally, Ayton's mentally checked out tonight, so we're just not playing him, so we're playing Jackson and Rob. Like, to me, it's like, yeah, we have three centers because we have zero centers, not we chose to have three centers, and in the process, now we have zero centers.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. I like the it's Rob Pelinka's favorite word, optionality, in that type of situation. All right, no laughing matter. Said, major fan. Thank you. How about Jake Vando to the Pelicans plus 3 first-round picks for Misi, Herb, and Sadiq Bey?
No, you can't give up 3 first-round picks with Herb Jones being the only primary target coming back.
I expected to see Trey Murphy in that when I saw the three first.
Yeah,
I thought Trey Murphy's name would be coming there.
And even then, I'd be like, questioning it a little bit, because that's your cash and trade of the Luka Doncic era.
That's everything. Yeah, that you're all in now. Plus connect to OKC for Wiggins and Joe. So in that scenario, you'd be absorbing like $16 million-ish in salary. Would you do that? Would you have 16 million less in cap space. Dalton Kincaid is gone, but you get Aaron Wiggins and Isaiah Joe.
I'm going to say no, and I'm actually going to spin this back on you. We can do this as our last thing for the day. I think it's, you know, obviously there's the reporting that Shea wants to push them to keep Dort. And Dort had his frustrations in this postseason run. It wasn't perfect. But, like, there's a version of the OKC offseason where they offload Wiggins, Joe, and Dort to try to clear space to facilitate the rest of the moves they need to make this summer. Do you think the Lakers should be making a run at Lou Dort?
If they part ways with him, if they decline the team option, yes. Maybe this is fan bias coming in, though. I don't think anybody should bail out OKC. You've built and built and built. You've got this absurd amount of talent. You knew the second apron was coming. What I don't want to see OKC able to do, and they probably will do it, is find a team with cap space to take their players and give the Thunder stuff for it. Because that's what they're going to want. They're going to want to pick up the team option on Lou Dort, that's $17 million. And they're going to want a team to absorb that $17 million plus give the Thunder some type of draft capital that they can walk away with and continue to replenish what's in their treasure trove of assets. That's the ideal world for OKC. That's what you're going to see a lot of Thunder fans talking about. I want to see OKC actually have to make the difficult decision and say, no, we don't want to be a second apron team. We have to just lose Lou Dort. We're going to decline the team option. Then if you're the Lakers, you come in and you can offer some of your cap space. You can come to terms on a free agent deal. I don't want to see the Thunder be able to have their cake and eat it too. And by that meaning they both clear the salary and open up the flexibility that they need to drop below the second apron and get more future assets in that process. So it depends on the path by which the Lakers get to Lou Dort. I'm not necessarily opposed to him becoming a Laker. I'm worried about the cheap shots and things like that. Of course, the three-point shooting, it's got to be a concern, though he shot the hell out of the ball against the Lakers because, of course, some concerns there in general. But if you're pursuing him in a free agency, to me, that's a different story than if you are trading for him at a $17 million valuation and giving up assets in order to do so.
Yeah, I kind of I agree with you in the sense that I'm not comfortable giving up substantial draft compensation, especially to OKC as part of a deal like this. But to me, the value add would be like, hey, we're willing to take on the salary for you, as you're mentioning. Yep. And there's a certain amount of, like, that's really the question mark is, like, is Dort's value just so insane, even coming off of a bad series, that OKC feels like if we go to the open market, we're going to get something for him. And that's where it gets complicated. So it's more theoretical than anything else. But I just think Dort would be the perfect fit in LA because, one, like, I think that playing alongside a guy like Luka, the cleanness of the three-point looks, I think, would benefit him. Two, he is unscreenable at times. And I think that that specifically would be really valuable in a system where you're trying to avoid Luka and Austin getting picked on. Like, say, for instance, JJ really wants to hedge and recover. The key to the hedge and recover is pressuring the ball handler enough so that your star can get out and get back. And Dort is kind of uniquely equipped to pest in that way. So, like, it's more to me, even though I think it's very unrealistic, it's more to me just philosophically, Dort is the kind of guy that I'd be like, boom, starting caliber three for our team.
Yeah, I think he could be with that screen navigation piece that you're talking about. Now, does his three-point shooting bounce back to where it was? Does it stay where it is? I tend to agree with you that with the quality of looks, though I'm sure he got great looks in OKC as well, but the quality of looks coming off of Luka, I think we get... So in 23-24, he shot 39% from deep. 24-25, he shot 41%. Well, this last season, 34%. I tend to think if he falls anywhere north of 36%, which I think is very much in the realm of possible outcomes, and I think the most likely outcome, then you feel pretty good about him, at least as a floor spacer. You add in the defensive chops. tone down the cheap shots a little bit for our own sake. But I think there's some real value there with that. It's just going to be interesting to see ultimately what OKC does with that salary. They built in the team option for a reason. I think they're going to prefer to keep Isaiah Hartenstein over Lu Dort, and that can make him very, very available. Though if the report that SGA really wants to keep him is true, maybe they're more motivated to just move on from Wiggins, Kenrich Williams, Isaiah Joe, and then try to clear their space that way. But OKC, they're not as fascinating as the Lakers, who are the most fascinating team of the summer, given all the different options. It's going to be really interesting to see ultimately what they do with some of those pieces, though, because they have so much depth. They've got guys on their team that aren't getting minutes that would get a lot of minutes elsewhere, and they're going to have to divest from some of these players this summer unless they just say, screw it, we'll be a second apron team, which I think is unlikely. So they're definitely a team to keep an eye on and potentially a team that the Lakers could be working with here this summer.
Yep, I agree.
All right, everybody. We appreciate all of you for joining. We're going to go rest up. Make sure you do hit the subscribe button if you haven't done so yet. Turn on those notifications. And Jason, thanks for gutting it out on today's show.
Of course. I'll be ready to gut it out again tomorrow. We're going tomorrow to cover the rest of the role players and get into some more kind of concepts for the offseason. Just Trevor and I again tomorrow, and the next week we'll have Jovan back.
That's right. That's right. And we'll have some more two-man shows throughout the summer, just as our schedules will create situations where one of us will be gone. But we'll always try to have at least two of us on here to talk. Appreciate all of you guys coming in. Again, hit the subscribe button if you haven't done so yet. Till next time. See ya and stay safe.